Hello, everyone. Real quick, I'm putting the show together now, and since Chris and I recorded together, more news has happened. The Azerbaijan Grand Prix has now also been postponed, and Canada, the one after it, is also likely to be postponed as well. That means that two races have been canceled, Australia and Monaco, and the others postponed: Bahrain, Vietnam, China, Netherlands, Spain, and Azerbaijan. Canada is not looking good. Just wanted to give that brief update. Okay, here's the show Chris and I recorded. Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 260 of the Fun with Cars Formula One podcast, or if you'd like, episode one of 2020. I'm Robin Warner, and today I'm joined by the man some call coronavirus free. And by God, I hope they're right. Chris Roche. Hey, Chris.
Hey, Robin. How you doing?
Ah, I'm lovely. I'm healthy. And I have to tell you, I have to share something personal with you and just a secret between you and me. I am doing this podcast on my bed. This is my bedroom wall behind me. So.
But I can assure the listeners I'm not in there with it.
No, we are much more than 6 feet apart, and I think everyone is the better for it. So, obviously, this is not the start to the season that we were expecting to have. This is not the start to the season. I suppose in a lot of ways this is still preseason. People went to Australia. In fact, most everyone went to Australia. But since people landed in Australia, one person was on the McLaren team was confirmed with coronavirus. And then later on, 14 others from the McLaren team were confirmed with coronavirus. One thing led to another, and that race was eventually canceled. And a lot of snowballing has happened since then. And to get some grounding of how this show is going to go, there was a statement by the CEO of Formula One, Chase Carey, on the 19th of March. I'm going to read the statement in its entirety right now. It's not terribly long, and I do have a smooth and sultry voice. You guys are going to love it. And then from there, Chris and I will talk about Formula One, what isn't happening, and all the ins and outs of that, plus some other forms of motorsports. Anyway, this is the announcement. Here it goes. During this exceptional time and following several race postponements and the World Motorsport Council's unanimous decision to move the Formula One summer break forward to March and April, we and the FIA discussed with the teams the needs for extra flexibility to accommodate a rescheduled season once COVID-19 situation improves. At the meeting, there was full support for the plans to reschedule as many of the postponed races as possible as soon as it was safe to do so. Formula One and the FIA will now work to finalize a revised 2020 calendar and will consult with the teams. But, as agreed at the meeting, the revised calendar will not require their formal approval. This will give us the necessary flexibility to approve revised timings with affected race promoters and to be ready to start racing at the right moment. In addition, as announced by the FIA, it was agreed unanimously at the meeting that the implementation of the technical regulations due to take effect from the 2021 season will be postponed until 2022. Due to the current volatile financial situation this has created, it has been agreed that the teams will use their 2020 chassis for 2021, with the potential freezing of further components to be discussed in due course. The introduction and implementation of the financial regulations will go ahead as planned in 2021. Fascinating. We are all very grateful for the collaborative nature of the discussions and fully united approach from all parties to get racing in 2020 as soon as the current global situation subsides. Formula One remains fully committed to launching a 2020 season as soon as possible. Best wishes, Chase. So, there it is. The super normal, totally common thing that happens every year in Formula One. World pandemic. So anyway, I don't know. Maybe the smartest place to start is the races that have been postponed.
I mean, I think we're all slightly in shock, aren't we, that Australia didn't happen because we got so close to having a race weekend.
So very close.
You know, we got through to Thursday, press conferences were going on, there was some debate amongst the drivers saying, you know, why are we here? There's bigger events unfurling outside.
Lewis Hamilton was certainly not the quietest among those drivers. He was
quite critical, yeah.
Exactly right.
So, you know, and as any seasoned F1 fan knows, right, the anticipation for the first weekend is enormous because, you know, we've all been glued to pre-season testing. We're not quite sure what the pecking order is. And so the first time you get a real understanding of it for real is qualifying in Australia. And we were denied that. So we still don't really know who's quick and who isn't.
That's right.
And we won't know for some time. But yeah, it was quite bizarre that they pulled the plug. I think it was the right decision. And of course, a lot of races have now since been postponed and one cancelled. So for sure, Monaco won't happen this year. And that is the jewel in the F1 crown. So that's a huge story in itself.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there was some practical matters with Monaco. Monaco couldn't be postponed and then rescheduled because Monaco, the city-state, has so much planned and all these things going around that is the one weekend that they can put on such an event in such a small place. That's kind of where my assumption lies, that they thought it's just not worth trying to find another weekend to make it work. And so it's like, well, if it's not happening in the middle of May or towards the end of May, it's just not happening. It's kind of a shocker. I mean, these are like, I'm not trying to equivocate here, but I'm getting a sense of like World War II ramping up kind of a vibe of like what's happening, what isn't, where is the normalcy going to fall, you know, but Monaco just being canceled was really something. But in addition to that, it wasn't just Monaco, of course. Oh, shoot. And I had my notes and they disappeared on me.
Yeah, so we lost Australia. Bahrain would have been this weekend. That's been postponed. Vietnam, which was a new race for 2020 and a brand new track, has been postponed. China, obviously, postponed the Dutch Grand Prix, which was making a welcome return. At a newly refurbished track in the sands by the coast in Holland, postponed, and Spain too. So I think the only one for
basically
sure
everything
happening.
Leading up to Monaco and including Monaco, but the Dutch and Spanish Grands Prix are postponed, technically not canceled outright.
Well, I think, aren't they all postponed with the exception of Monaco? So, for example, Bahrain might be pushed back to a double header with Abu Dhabi. So that might be now the penultimate Grand Prix this year, potentially, is what they're talking about. So,
What about Australia? I thought that was cancelled.
Yeah, I thought that too, but some of the press releases I've been reading indicated maybe not. But yeah, I mean, I think that the bigger question is, when are we really going to get started? They're talking about the first race potentially being Baku in Azerbaijan on June 7th. So the idea is that they've pulled the summer break forward. So essentially they're on that now, which has the, you know, the double benefit of preventing the teams from continuing to develop their cars in this fallow period. And sort of obviously looking after the health of their employees and tending to other matters. It also allows them to pack more races in that prime summer period in August when, you know, hopefully the world will have returned to some level of normalcy and we can enjoy some motorsport again. So we might see a lot of these races popping up where they're not normally encountered.
Here is what is really fascinating to me, because you've certainly had different countries and regions react to the coronavirus in very different ways, and that has affected the severity of the outbreak, but it is a bit of a different scenario, like In Russia, it's effectively a non-issue. In Mexico, it's a very small issue. In China, they're largely past that. In the automotive world, automotive plants are starting to reopen, and life is starting to return back to normal after 3 months. But in the U.S., you know, cases are still on a huge upward swing. Italy is still in a big is still in a big mess, and maybe for a while. And it is actually also maybe not at the same rate, but coronavirus cases are definitely on the upswing in the UK, where the vast majority of the teams are. So are you going to start seeing where some regions are like, hey, coronavirus has passed us now, but where the teams are actually based is actually going to be what draws the actual schedule reopening, not necessarily where the regions where the races are. And in that case, does the whole world have to calm down from this for this to for the season to kick off?
I think for sure it has to calm down in Europe, doesn't it? And particularly Italy and the UK. I think once we get control of it in those countries, then you can start to hold races again. And where those races are, I guess, will depend on the situation on the ground. But there was some speculation that Silverstone, once Britain recovers, Silverstone would be an easy one, right, to just pop up. And they could probably have a few there if they need to, because
right.
I think the big thing that no one's talking about is the financial consideration, right? There's obviously a lot of money that's been either paid or will be paid on the back of televising the 2020 F1 schedule. And if those races don't happen, then everyone's out a lot of cash. And so there is going to be some pressure to have hold some races, maybe even with no spectators.
Well, but then there gets to another issue, which is kind of dark and could have longer term effects, which is the tracks themselves, because Formula One has such a tight hold on the revenue streams and who makes money in what areas and all that kind of stuff, that the tracks largely depend on ticket sales to bring in any kind of revenue for Formula One racing. Well, if you start having regional openings, Formula One is very much a world sport. Obviously, the vast majority of the people that come to the race are regional people, but people do go to different events from around the world. And there's also going to be different fear levels. And ticket sales to the tracks are going to suffer. Almost certainly they're going to suffer to some degree, and they could suffer pretty severely in some cases, depending on how they're rescheduled, how much time they have, and what the coronavirus situation is. And then you have circumstances like Circuit of the Americas in Texas has shut down, laid off all its employees, and they've kind of gone idle, and there's no... It's not going to be for 30 days or 60 days. They said it's indefinite. They don't know how long this is going to last. So there's some tracks, COTA may be one of them, that might not even sustain the economical impact of this outbreak. And that's before we get into airlines and all those other things and the rest.
Well, and then, of course, there's the possibility of second rounds of coronavirus. I mean, until the world develops a vaccine and a way to... quickly treat people or detect the virus quickly and then quarantine it, then the concern will be is that people travel around the world again, that they can then carry the virus back to countries that have recovered from it. So I think there's going to be a lot of wariness of opening up borders and allowing international travelers and, teams until the whole situation is under control and you can ensure that you're not going to have a second period of infection. So, there's a lot of unknowns there, and there's a lot of, there could be circuits going out of business, it could be race teams going out of business, obviously outside of Formula One and inside of Formula One. So, yeah, there's a lot at risk here. This could change everything as we know it. But hopefully, you know, I do find it, you know, astonishing that a sport as big and as successful and has made as much money as this can't sustain at least a few months of inactivity and not bounce back from it. And I think the interest levels, once we return to international sport, will be massive, because people will, you know, will be wanting to lap this up and go back to a period of normal behavior.
Yeah, and I completely agree with that. And I have a hunch that there's been a lot of this professional drivers doing virtual racing and putting on virtual race events. I have a feeling, and I think another way to say it is, I'm also kind of hopeful that doesn't have good staying power. That people are like, "Oh, this is a lark. I'll check this out," and then they'll say, "Okay, I've had enough of this." And long term thinking, here's silver lining. It might actually increase popularity of motor racing, because there is a little bit of that. Ah, okay, this is clearly something more than just watching a computer program video game on TV. So that's the silver lining to it. Now, you might be thinking, hey, all right, Formula One's a worldwide sport. I have to ignore that for a little while. That's okay. I'll just watch some of the other racing series that are more local to Europe or to the United States, like IMSA or IndyCar. Alas, you're still out of luck. The IndyCar season right now is effectively going to start at the Indianapolis 500, possibly maybe the Grand Prix of Indianapolis, which is at the track, but two weeks prior to the Indianapolis 500. But that is very much where IndyCar, quote unquote, hopes to start. And as the outbreak spreads, it's actually looking less likely than more so. IMSA, the sports car racing in the United States, they've canceled all events until the Detroit Grand Prix, which is scheduled for May 30th, something I do hope to attend. I do hope it happens. I do hope to attend it if it happens. But IMSA has canceled all of its events up to May 30th. The 12 Hours of Sebring, one of their marquee events, was actually rescheduled already. The 12 Hours of Sebring will happen November 14th. So theoretically, the 12 Hours of Sebring will be the season finale for IMSA. So, and a quick little plug, I actually did a couple of stories with a great driver, IMSA driver named Brian Sellers. And it was scheduled and did run ahead of the 12 Hours of Sebring for when the 12 Hours of Sebring was originally supposed to happen. So I'll put a link to that in the show notes so you can, if you have any interest, read a little bit about Brian Sellers, who will be at Sebring in November, assuming everything works out. So, yeah, and then the World Endurance Championship, you wanted to talk about Le Mans as well, Chris.
Yeah, Fernando Alonso is having a rough time, because obviously if the Indy doesn't happen this year, his quest to get the Triple Crown to match Graham Hill's long ago feat back in the 60s will go on for another year. But yeah, Le Mans is going to move. The French have been quite decisive. They've moved Le Mans back to September. They've moved the French Open tennis back to September. So it'd be a busy month in France.
Yeah, yeah. And how do you feel about September? To me, it feels like a rational decision, because they, you know, we're talking about schedules restarting in mid to late May. Le Mans was mid-June, and yet they still decided to postpone it. So how do you feel about that decision?
I haven't read a lot about how they came up with that. And, you know, I think similar to Monaco, right? You're basically closing down public roads. So I guess they've been quite conservative there. You've got to make sure that the public situation's basically returned to complete normality before you can start closing down roads. And also I mean, I think the big issue is drawing emergency services away from, you know, more urgent requirements than just attending a motor race. But you need to have all the support crews there in order to be able to host these things. So it probably seems like a good thing to punt it far enough into the future that we should be well clear of this by then.
Yeah, and I think you make a really good point about the public roads. I've been lucky enough to go to Le Mans a couple of times, and I remember I did this big long walk around the track, and I exited the track grounds, and I found myself at a roundabout, and you could see signs saying, you know, this way to Le Mans or whichever direction it was, and it was the straight, it was Le Sarthe, so. I could see the roundabout that would go down what was the main straight. And I was just kind of like, oh, and it added so much realness to it. But it drives home your point of the logistical challenge of putting together the 24 hours Le Mans is a genuinely enduring thing, because you have the idea of putting together a street course that's 9 miles long and such a big world event. So I agree with you. I respect the decision. And I do think that similar to what IMSA did with the 12 hours of Sebring, I think pushing it well past the dates where a lot of people think that this should start coming around and turn a corner gives you not only some time to let things adjust and you still have time to pass, but also gives time for a little bit of rebuilding, some economic rebuilding, a better understanding of what race teams, as you mentioned, are in real trouble, what industries are in real trouble, what different countries are in real trouble. There's a lot of fallout yet to play out, and giving it more time rather than less seems like the smart move to me, as opposed to having to re-postpone something.
Yeah, I agree. But I think we should circle back and let's get excited about what we were going to be in store for in 2020.
Oh,
because that might be a bit more positive. People might want to listen to that.
I thought we were having such a positive conversation already. I'm sorry. Did you not think that? No, it's dire. It's dire straits. It's a real deal that we're dealing with. But 100% absolutely agree with you. We had a lot of preseason testing happening, and like you said, were the Australian Grand Prix a week earlier than it was scheduled to be, it would have happened. We were that close.
Yeah, there was a lot that went on. I mean, we had teams being rebranded, teams being purchased. We had 6 days of testing in Spain, and so we had the rather spectacular launch of AlphaTauri, which is the new name for Scuderia Toro Rosso, which is still owned by Red Bull, and that is the fashion brand of Red Bull. I didn't know they had a fashion brand until until that moment. I didn't know,
but not at all surprised. I mean, you know, it's one of those things. Of course, he owns something like that. Speaking of ownership, what's Lance Stroll's father's name again? Lawrence Stroll?
Lawrence Stroll, I think it is. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Last I read, Lawrence Stroll, that individual, that one person owns now 25% of Aston Martin.
I think he assembled a consortium, but yes, you're right. He is leading that consortium that now owns a quarter of Aston Martin. And so Racing Point will be rebranded Aston Martin for 2021. I assume that's still the plan. They didn't make any statement to contradict that. So,
which is rather shocking to me that the team owner buys into Aston and then, well, of course he can rebrand it Aston Martin if he wants. He owns, I mean, effectively he only has to convince, I'm obviously oversimplifying this greatly, but he only has to convince three other people that it's like, well, I own a quarter of it, so that includes this.
I could see how that happened. So obviously Lance needed somewhere to drive, so he bought a Formula One team. Then Lance needed a company car, so he went and bought Aston Martin. Right? I think that's how it works.
Well, Lance is going to have to fly to different places to get there, so Is he going to buy Delta next or Air Canada, I suppose, would be the correct thing? Is there an Air Montreal that I'm not aware of? Is there a Quebecois brand? I mean, Bombardier is a Quebecois thing. So maybe he's going to buy Bombardier next.
Who knows? Who knows? But yeah, the pink
no, racing I'm not point done for yet. This.
Oh, but okay. What else is going to go?
You have a young son.
Yes, I do.
And he fancies racing.
Uh-huh. I'm not going to buy Aston Martin.
What companies are you going to buy for your own son? Don't tell me that you love your son less than Lawrence loves Lance.
Yeah, I mean, of course, we're all willing to make sacrifices for our children. I bought him the old soccer ball. That is true.
I heard you bought him a new soccer ball even.
It would be great to be in that situation, wouldn't it? I mean, the guy, I know he's a billionaire. I think he's self-made, right? What was it? The clothing? I mean, good, yeah, fair play to him. Done well, looking after his lad. So, I'm not going to begrudge him that. I mean, it is funny. He is, he's got some interesting ideas. Is now the pink Mercedes for 2020 is what the Racing Point has been christened. And the thing looks quick. They basically have copied the full Mercedes aero package. Obviously, they buy the Mercedes powertrain and gearbox, and they've gone on all in to emulate the Mercedes aerodynamic philosophy. And Racing Point was quick, fourth quickest team in Spain.
I think there's two things to consider. I think Racing Point, to a certain extent, learned from Haas, because Haas leaned heavily on Ferrari technical parts and basically maximized what the technical regulations allowed them to take from Ferrari. And then they said, thank you very much. We'll have all those bits. And Racing Point saw that, you know, there was opportunity there. So I think that's perfectly reasonable on their part. And also, I mean, Force India has been a plucky, clever, quick team for several years. They've been, you know, punching above their weight financially. And I think there's a lot of good, smart people there. And I'm still big time playing catch up here, but I recently listened to the Beyond the Grid podcast with Otmar. I'm not even going to attempt his last name. I'll butcher it, but poorly, terribly. But
that's an old one. That was like mid-19.
Oh, yeah.
That
came like out. I said, I'm way, way behind. I listen to political podcasts as well. And as you can imagine, those are getting longer and longer. Otmar was fascinating. And he and I have something in common. We both have worked at Ford Motor Company. So how about that? I think Force India is an incredibly plucky team, a very clever group of people. And to me, because they finished fourth in the Constructors' Championship. That was probably 3 years ago now, but they've been very competitive before.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, and Lance, and his dad are investing a lot into the team. They are investing heavily in the resources to build the team up in terms of the wind tunnel. I think they're building a new wind tunnel. They're expanding the workforce. They are, you know, bringing in a lot of the tools and equipment that the other leading teams use. And it's not just about trying to copy last year's Mercedes. It's a bit more sophisticated than that. But, yeah, there's a lot of investment going on in there, and they look like they're on the up, which is great. It's going to cause some of the other midfield teams some major headaches, though. I mean, there's a lot of pressure on Renault, still a fair bit of pressure on McLaren to succeed. So for Racing Point to leapfrog them this year would be a problem for them. And then, are you also watching the Drive to Survive second series, or are you behind?
No, I'm. I have a terrible time watching much of any television, to be honest with you.
Because it's fascinating. I mean, the behind the scenes look into as it unraveled last season. I mean, that team, I don't see them bouncing back this year. They had no clue what was going on last year with the lack of performance. You know, it's every bit as bad as it looked from the outside on the inside. So, it is a good series, well worth watching. I mean, the whole Gasly and Albon developments were also covered in quite a lot of detail. And so it is a great opportunity to get your F1 fix before there's any 2020 racing underway.
And I think this is a good point. We are not sponsored by either of those brands. We're just we're just fans. So, and then, of course, Mercedes looked strong in the preseason testing. That was no surprise to anyone. I am going to take this opportunity to cheerlead Honda a little bit here. I know.
That's a shock.
Shocker. you know, I really think that Honda was on a path to really close some gaps power-wise again and start getting pretty tight and making good power. And I obviously an Adrian Newey chassis with a good, powerful engine is going to be a tough combination. And Verstappen is still highly, highly coveted, right? So they were definitely going to be ones to watch, and perhaps even more so than Ferrari. Ferrari does not seem to be in a place where they're ready to really take on world championship challenge.
Yeah, I mean, the headline times were dominated by Mercedes over single lap and race distance runs. But for sure, when there was quite a few people that tried to crunch the numbers and looked at the tires, weather conditions, fuel loads, and it does look like the three teams are quite close. There's only going to be a couple of tenths in it between Mercedes, Ferrari, and Red Bull. Interestingly, you know, Ferrari were much more diligent in terms of understanding, you know, the performance of the vehicle, correlating the vehicle performance to their test data rather than just going for headline times, which they did last year. But I think, you know, the biggest glimmer of hope for the opposition is the fact that Mercedes had some reliability issues, right? They had a number of power unit failures one in their car and a couple of the other teams that run their units. And they actually had to get them to dial the power unit back for the last day of testing. But I think the fascinating thing for me is the whole Ferrari power unit situation. They were running significantly slower than most of the teams, certainly in the first 3 days. And they seemed to be very conservative in terms of top-end power, which was, you know, sharp contrast to the fact that they had by far the most powerful engine at the end of 19. And then, you know, we had this mysterious announcement that Ferrari and the FIA had come to an agreement that their engine was actually illegal, but nothing was going to be done about it, and that they reached an agreement between themselves, which the other nine teams, excluding the Ferrari teams, of course, that run Ferrari units, all were rather upset about that. So it's interesting to see really where Ferrari are in terms of powertrain performance. They claimed that they were going for a much more draggy car, therefore a car that's quicker in the corners, slow on the straights, but I think there's a bit more to it than that. But yeah, it looks like everything was teed up nicely for a cracking start to the season, with Mercedes maybe just still having the slight edge, but maybe a smaller edge than they had at the start of 19.
Well, and this was going to be the last season before we had a major rule shakeup to kind of give us the opportunity to reset the playing field. And obviously, from the statement I read earlier, that's not going to be the case. 2021 will effectively be the same set of rules, and more so than most times, be very similar to the same car that we're going to see in 2020. So it's, in a way, almost going to be kind of a season and a half of racing with these cars, much more so than what we've seen in the past. And that's going to be fascinating to see if there does end up being a clear front-running car, and how those things will infect things in 2022. So, fascinating times.
Well, especially as you had some quite interesting technical developments with Mercedes introducing the DAS system, the dual-axis steering.
That's right. Thank you for bringing that up. That slipped my mind. That seemed like years ago.
Right.
You push the steering wheel forward, and that basically eliminated the camber. And by eliminating the camber, you were able to reduce drag and slightly improve aerodynamics. Tell me if I'm getting this right. And that increase the top end of the car.
And also tire wear is supposed to be slightly marginally better as well.
Yeah. Okay. And that
so an aero and a tire wear benefit. So, yeah, I mean, it's quite a fascinating, you know, idea, and it's shocking that only one of the teams was able to come up with it. And you know, the bigger issue is that if it is beneficial, the other teams were saying they wouldn't be able to introduce it for months. So Mercedes would have maybe half a season's worth of a head start with that on their vehicle. So that would be obviously huge.
Except now that there's no racing going on, you know, other teams have the chance to replicate.
Well, apart from they're on an enforced vacation, so they shouldn't be working at all, right?
Right. It is the summer break, technically speaking, is it not? Yeah. That's a good point.
Well, and it sounds like the F1 teams are all working on ventilator production. Certainly, I think in Italy and the UK, McLaren, Mercedes are all trying to help figure out how to quickly, using some of, you know, their rapid prototyping and capability to produce parts very quickly, to how they can help with adding more ventilators to the NHS in the UK and the Italian health system.
Yeah, and it's a good way to go. That there's been talk. I don't think anything's actually been finalized just yet, but automotive plants in the US switching from building cars to building ventilators and doing similar work. Unless there's anything specifically pressing that you wanted to touch on, Chris, I actually wanted to move towards something a little bit more personal, which is how has the pandemic personally affected you and I, and what your scenario is and what mine is.
Okay.
I'll start.
Well, mine's not very interesting, so well, you might as well.
I'm very fortunate to say that mine's not that interesting as well. You know, I've been working with at home for a little more than a week now, but I'm still working. I still have a job, and I'm very lucky in the fact that, you know, the day-to-day work that I have to do, there's still an appetite for automotive news, racing news, and automotive stories. And on the web, it's still extremely easy to maintain social distancing and consume that. So there's still a demand for the type of work that I do. So I'm very lucky there. And working from home is a marginal impact. I had to move my desk. I had to move my desk to a more convenient place that I can use every day, but it's been very fortunate and minimal, and the economic impact to my family so far has been pretty negligent. And so, for that reason, that's one of the reasons why I can do this, is we can spend the time doing podcasts, because I'm not desperately searching for some kind of work I can do instead. And how about you?
Yeah, it's very similar. I mean, fortunately, nobody in my family or circle have been affected yet, you know, other than adjusting to life in quarantine, essentially, right? I think both in the UK and the US, right, people have been encouraged to not socialize over the last few days. So my family, you know, the more higher risk elements of my family, they're basically staying at home, but so far so good, and they're getting food and seem to be well and happy, as well as you can be in this situation. So for us here, you know, my wife and I and the kids have all been home for over a week, and you know, it's more about trying to learn to live together and operate and function than anything else, really. It's like, how do we share an office? So my wife and I used to work together a long, long time ago when we were both at Chrysler. But she works, you know, for another car company. I work for an engineering service company now. And so to now suddenly be thrown back into an office together and, you know, having a lot of web meetings is the biggest challenge we face, really. And then trying to entertain the children or help them with their homework. I mean, so, yeah, it's all... you do sort of have to stop yourself worrying where this might lead to, and obviously we think twice about going out and doing things that you're used to doing, and that's the big adjustment. But other than that, I mean, it's not that bad a situation yet, fortunately.
Right. Yeah, and that, in a lot of ways, you know, Harrison is 3.5 now. He's still largely. It's not easy, but it is fairly simple in terms of entertaining him. But your daughter, she was getting into tennis, and your son played soccer. So obviously, I'm assuming that has been canceled. How have they coped with the fact that those things aren't happening right now?
Well, so my daughter's 13, my son's 8, and they're both extremely busy with, our lives revolve around their activities. So to give you some idea, this year already we've been to Milwaukee and Chicago on choir trips with my daughter, who's performed in two different choirs, which was good. We got out and about and saw some things before we had to stay in the house. The week that it got slightly serious here, she was going to be performing at the DSO.
At Concert Hall.
Yeah.
And that's in Detroit, Michigan, and it's a very grand hall, very grand facility.
Yeah, so she sings for an organization called the AAYC, the Ann Arbor Youth Chorale, and they were going to be assisting with part of the performance of Carmina Burana at the DSO, and she had actually already done a rehearsal there, and they had to scrap the whole thing. So, you know, and as you said, they both do a lot of sports. It's all been scrapped. So now, you know, it's all of a sudden you have all this time, right? And you're not able to do any of these things. So, I mean, we're quite fortunate. We have a lot of green space at the back of our house. There's parks close by, and, you know, you can still go to them. You can still get out. The weather's pretty nice for Michigan at the moment, isn't it?
Well, considering the time of year, yeah.
Yeah. So we've been getting out and about, and obviously, you know, just as a family and not getting friends and involved because you can't, but we can still get out and play baseball in the yard or kick a soccer ball around or whatever. So, I mean, that's what we've been up to.
Yeah. And you know, our house has some space too. So we're, right. We're extremely fortunate that we can be quarantined and not smothering each other, not isolated and not confined, you know, no one's walls are closing in on them just yet. But it is fascinating. I'll be in the middle of something and then I find myself in kind of an emergency with Harrison. It's like, oh no, I need to entertain him right now, or we're going to have serious meltdowns to deal with. So those are the interesting, conversations you have. And then the debates on when is the right time to go grocery shopping and what level of care do we take to turn in terms of cautious about touching, being rigorous about hand washing, and on those types of things. But all in all, just as you were suggesting, I mean, these are ultimately very minor adjustments to make. So very lucky for that. So
yeah, we're very fortunate.
So we talked as listeners know, with the job I have now, it got very, very difficult to truly give race-to-race coverage of the Formula One season. So Chris and I have been discussing about ways of adjusting the podcast to be more relevant and topical and not necessarily covering race-to-race. There's been ideas thrown around of just hitting the main news story and the trends of the season, stuff like that. I, of course, added the idea that we should record the podcast in a bar every time we record it. That, of course, will be pandemic circumstantial. But if you, the listener, have any things that you'd like to hear from us, any suggestions? We're all ears for that. And Chris, I'm opening it to you in this public forum to be the first to say what we should do differently for the podcast. Should I speak in a British accent for the entire podcast? Hello, top of the morning to you.
Please don't.
Oh, it's a problem, governor. That's appropriate, right? I did it. Yep, spot on.
There you go. I think that probably covers it. We can move on now.
A spot of tea. Fancy a spot of tea?
Does it get better when you've been drinking?
No, sadly. It's really a shame because in my mind, it's actually quite good. But I don't know how to translate mind to mouth.
It sounds like you're trying to be an extra from a Mary Poppins movie that was recorded 50 years ago.
It is shockingly common that the accent that people use is actually Mary Poppins, and it is so grotesquely terrible. You know, listening to you all the time, I have other English friends, and you know, listen to folks like Lewis Hamilton. He's never said "govna," not once.
I don't even think he refers to Toto as the governor, does he? That would be quite amusing if he did.
But you do say some weird things like pasta, whatever that is.
Yeah. So one of the funny things my wife and I argue about is the word croissant, because I think, you know, you've got to pronounce it as the French might try to.
Yeah,
But people, certainly in Michigan, don't. And if you ask for a croissant, they have no idea what you're asking for.
Yeah, no. No, it depends on who you're speaking with. When you say croissant, I understand and appreciate that. If you say I'd like a croissant, they'll be, do you want a croissant? Is that what you're asking for?
Right.
But you know, I'm generally, you know, when I, you know, working at Hyundai, I tried to say it as a Korean say it. So I pronounce the Y and I try to say it more or less properly. That's one thing I noticed, that it seems like the English tend to sometimes do where
they're sure everyone else's language.
Yeah, exactly. They get pretty particular. It's not a Jaguar, it's a Jaguar. And but then they say Hyundai, and that's not correct at all. And I know you know that because you also work there. So
yeah, so I don't think we should really do accents during the podcast.
So that's where we're on the fence about English accents for both of us. Or I could do an English accent and you could do an American accent and really throw
people. I've been trying
out
for 20 years. This is the best the best you're gonna get.
That would be what would be if you were to do your slang American accent, would you hit us with a howdy partner all of a sudden?
Oh God, I don't know. I mean, it would be just as bad as your attempt. Let me think. No, I'm not going to do an accent, Robin. You're not going to force me to do it. I think really the pod should just be us discussing the really big, you know, rather than trying to cover each race in turn or whatever's occurred that month in the world of motorsport, we should just hit the highlights. So the big fights, the great wins, the interesting talking points, and we can just cover that and argue about, you know, is Hamilton greater than Schumacher once he's equaled his 7 world titles? Those sort of things.
I disagree. See, there we go. Arguing, huh?
So what should we be covering? Formula E?
Oh my God, no, Jesus. No, I watched one Formula E race, and it was entertaining. There's a lot about Formula E that I respect, but I have a really hard time making that emotional leap to really cover it. IndyCar is natural for me. Formula One is natural for me. Formula One has become my distinct number one, even though I grew up with IndyCar. Obviously, people know that I still cherish IndyCar, and I'm getting to know I'm very fortunate in my job that I'm getting to know a few of the drivers here and there. And IMSA, to an even greater degree, I'm starting to get to know a few of the drivers there. One I knew for a while when I was racing, and he ended up in IMSA. But so on a personal level, I have a lot of respect for IMSA, which is Sports Car Racing US. And I should say North America. They do go to Canada. I think they race at Mossport, which is now the Canadian Tire Motorsport Park, which is such a shame because it's such a terrible name for such a fantastic track. So Formula E just, I haven't been able to make that emotional connection to it yet. Does that make sense?
It does, but you see, this, what's suckering me in is the all the manufacturers starting to come in. So when it was the likes of, some of the smaller EV players, and then the likes of Mahindra and DS, it wasn't that interesting. But now you've got some pretty big manufacturers going toe-to-toe in Formula E, and you've got some pretty good drivers. So,
Definitely the driver quality is high.
Now, there's still some gimmicky things that I don't like about Formula E, but the fact that they can use the same car for the entire race is definitely a big plus. And some of the racing isn't bad because they're relatively low downforce cars, so they can follow each other. I mean, I think you have to get over the lack of the normal motorsport noise, and a lot of the motor whining is a bit of a put off. But once you can sort of get past that, it's not bad. And I've always had a soft spot for Jaguars, and they're actually doing all right this season. So, it's not bad. I'm always going to pick Formula One or IndyCar for that matter over Formula E, but it's certainly getting more of my interest and it's on my radar now. Of course, they've suspended racing for 2 months, so we can't watch any of that either.
Well, Formula E in a lot of ways suffer hardest from this because their whole play is to race in city centers. So they have to be in a – there's no – well, we won't invite spectators. There's no compromise at that level. You know,
right.
So, and obviously there's logistical challenge with every event they put on for the exact same reason. But I'm with you, and I actually do appreciate the low, cause it's not even low aero. It's pretty low mechanical grip as well. So those cars slide around a lot, and you do have electric motor torque, which is high and instantaneous. So there's a lot of, I was impressed by how many sideways moments you'd see in Formula E. And I think they're good looking cars, and I think the quality of the driving's high. But yeah, I guess it's an audio issue a little bit, the motor whining, which is something I agree I could get over. But I think there was also a bit of, for me personally, bear in mind that I'm really not intelligent and all. I'm very stupid. And so I can only follow so much racing at a time before it all blurs into one gray blob. And I think that was part of it. I was diluting myself too thin.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. It is impossible to follow, I think, too many series at once. And you just, you know, I think most of the, for me, the interest in any of these series is to get to know more about the drivers, about the teams, some of the backstory, what's going on, right? Rather than just the superficial level where you watch the race. So if you're really that invested, there's only so many series you can possibly follow and still, you know, be married, have children, have a full-time job.
Exactly.
And get a few hours of sleep.
I could follow it and be divorced. I think that's entirely possible. But that you brought up another interesting point because there are so many different manufacturers. It's getting very enticing at that level. But how much difference between the cars is there really? It's highly regulated in terms of how different those cars are. Spec motors, spec batteries, are they not? So
I forget. I did read about this a few months ago, but it's a spec chassis, and there are certain powertrain components that are spec. You're right, because it was with the first version, the battery was entirely supplied to every team by Williams. But I believe the powertrain in terms of the motor is developed by the manufacturer or, you know, a partner that they so choose. So there is some areas that they can differentiate in terms of vehicle performance and develop themselves, but it is quite limited, certainly compared to F1. But I don't know who's, I think, is it McLaren that did this year's battery? But it's still a spec battery, I believe. So they're not allowing the batteries to be the area of development. It's more the motor and the drivetrain.
Well, you know, and that's good. I think more development is a good thing. What about, have you followed any of these virtual races that have happened in lieu of the actual racing?
You know, interestingly enough, the only racing I caught the other day was some WRC, and I used to love World Rally Championship.
Yeah.
And,
as did I, yeah.
Yeah, and it's like, well, you know, is it a case that it's not interesting anymore? It's just nobody pays any attention to it. So I was trying to get back into that. So I'm going to continue to find forms of racing that are real, or go back to the, you know, rich back catalogue that we can enjoy before I go to virtual racing. I'll go in. I'm quite happy to go and race myself virtually. I'm not going to watch somebody else do it, though. I'm sorry. That's exactly. Crossing the line for me. Yeah.
Exactly. Yep. I'm with you 100% of the way there. And in fact, I am slowly working on getting my virtual, you can't see this in the audio, of course, but I'm air quoting my virtual race setup, because I am slowly but surely making progress there.
So I haven't thought about the answer to this myself, but if you had to watch three classic races to tide you over until 2020 kicks off, what would they be? It could be Formula One, or they could be other.
Well, motorsport races. I think the first one that comes to mind is the actual Brazil 2008, when Hamilton won his first championship where Massa had it all tied up. He did everything he could have done, and then the last few turns, Hamilton got past Timo Glock in the Toyota. And won his first championship. That race was really something. There was Montreal, was it 2010 or 2012, where Jenson Button, he was in the McLaren, and he started near the front, ended up in back, and then passed Vettel on the last lap to win the race. But I don't remember if that was 10 or 12.
I was thinking the exact same race, but I can't remember the year either. And I didn't even think he was in the McLaren, but you might be right.
I'm pretty sure he was in the, because it was not a Honda. And I don't think it was the Braun car. So I had to be a McLaren.
But it's interesting that you're going so recent as well, because the first race I wrote down was Monaco 92. So this was the year that the Williams FW14B was dominating. Ooh. Mansell was winning. And at a canter, had a puncture, and Senna managed to beat him. And those final seven laps are cracking.
Oh, yeah. No, I've seen YouTube highlights of that. Well, but to be fair, I hadn't done all three yet.
Yeah, you're right. But it was interesting that they were both quite recent. But they're both good races.
Well, and what about you? Give me two more.
I mean, there's been so many cracking races, aren't there? I mean, I've got. Do you have any of the old season review? There's a company called Duke in the UK that does a season review every year, and so they'll do highlights from every race of the entire season. And I've got quite a few of those. So I was thinking, if I get desperate, I'm going to start watching them again. but so Monaco, that was a great season for me. 92. I mean, you got to go back to Senna and Prost. I mean, you got to go back to 88, haven't you? I mean, you've got to go back to some of those vintage years where you had some of the greatest drivers, you know, in the same equipment going hammer and tongs at each other. I mean, there's...
In fact, that would be my third choice, actually. I think it would be Suzuka. And I thought, I mean, really any of the years, but I thought it was 89 where Prost and Senna got together in the hairpin after 130R.
Well, that's right, yeah. Two championship deciders at Suzuka on consecutive years.
Yeah.
When they were in both in McLaren's in 89 and then in a McLaren and Ferrari the following year. And yeah, I mean, those are, of course, that's not a long race review. That's the first 30 seconds of one of those races.
but I would definitely go back. Suzuka generally.
Yeah.
And the MP44 was crazy. And I think that was 89, was it not? Or was that 90?
The 4.4 was 88.
Oh, sorry. Okay, I apologize.
Yeah, and then, they were both still in McLaren at 89, and that was when Prost hit Senna in the chicane and managed to win the championship despite Senna restarting and winning the race. Valles screwed him that year, which is why Senna then drove into him the following year.
He was still
angry about it.
Yep.
So you go to 91 when Senna won his third championship. I mean, there were some cracking races there when he finally won at home in Brazil.
Right. Yes, that was a good one. And he was like, he barely had the energy to get out of the car afterwards.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. Shoulder injury. Or you could look at Donington in 93, where Senna won brilliantly in the rain. That was another great race.
Well, actually, what there's another one. I don't remember the year, but it was Jackie Stewart. And I think it was maybe it was early 70s. Where he won Nürburgring in the wet, and he lapped the field. He was like in this other level, complete, just godlike zone of driving, and no one could even get close to him.
Yeah, I mean, I think you'd want to just go back through some of the different eras. So the Senna-Prost era was pretty good, and then of course you had the Schumacher period, Schumacher-Hakkinen. I mean, that race, what was the year where they battled at Spa? And you had the three car pass.
Oh, yes, yes. Oh,
that was a cracker.
I think that was 98. I think that's the one. I think 98. I hope I'm right.
Yeah, that's good. That's got to be close. I agree with you.
Yeah.
When Mika was in the McLaren again, and Shuey was coming with the Ferrari, and they had some cracking races.
Yeah.
So, and then of course we've had the Alonso, Vettel, Hamilton, more recent period. So, yeah, been a lot of good races over the years, and plenty to go back and enjoy in this period.
You know, one I would like to see, not for a particular race, but just to see, I would love to see some footage of Jim Clark.
Mm.
Because I know he's considered one of the absolute greats, but I don't have any firm memories of him actually seeing footage of him racing.
Yeah, you can see the odd clips that are rolled out are him at Indy, because of course he raced for Lotus at Indy, and then in the Lotus Cortina racing touring cars in Britain.
Really?
Where he's got the car on three wheels. You know, one of the things we didn't really talk about what we did over the Christmas period, but I went back to the UK, and we went up to Edinburgh for New Year's. Oh. And one of the things I really wanted to do was to go to the Jim Clark Museum opened last year. And they shut it down over the Christmas period, believe it or not. It shuts from like October through to March or April.
You're kidding me.
It's in a place called Dunn's. And so I was gutted. I even emailed them and said, are you going to open over Christmas? Because I'd love to come and see it. And because Dario Franchitti helped open the museum. In fact, one of his cars that Dario owns is in the museum permanently at the moment. It's a Lotus Cortina, because Dario is a huge Clark fan. And I thought, oh, that'd be awesome. They got a lot of his trophies, some of his racing equipment from back in the day, because he was the man back in the 60s, right? Undoubtedly, they all said he was the greatest of their generation. And obviously we lost him too soon in a silly F2 race in Hockenheim. But yeah, it was a shame. So I'll have to go back to Scotland in the summer and finally make it to that museum.
And have some scotch for me.
Yeah. And well, talking of museums, Silverstone's just opened one too. So if you go into the UK anytime soon, some good motorsport related museums to check out.
Oh, well, very good. So my Christmas break was totally boring. But it was enjoyable nonetheless, so I have nothing to share, really. I just want to send a quick note. I hope everyone is safe and healthy and doing well, and that the coronavirus is something that isn't impacting your life too much at the time. Wishing everyone the best of luck there. And on an optimistic note, I think we will eventually get through this. As a people, I think we will survive it. So I want to thank you for listening. Please take a moment to review us on iTunes or on whatever platform you get our podcasts. Please leave comments on the episode of your choice by going to funwithcars.com. As always, I can be reached at feedback@funwithcars.com. Tweet us at fun_with_cars. And check out our Facebook page at facebook.com/FWCars. Chris, episode 1 of 2020 in the bag.
Excellent. Thank you, everybody. Stay safe.
I'm Robin Warner. Goodbye.